Good evening, everyone. When Terry sits down, we can begin. Good evening and welcome to Waterloo Federation of Agriculture's annual meeting and banquet. Thank you for coming. It's a beautiful night. Wish all the nights were like this from now on until we're done harvest, but we can only hope. So as is our tradition, we're going to eat first and talk later. So if you'd bow your heads, I'll say grace. Good God, thank you for this day. Thank you for bountiful crops and good weather when they come. Bless this food and bless our fellowship around the table. Amen. So continue with conversation and we'll be served when the food comes. Well, good evening, everyone, again. I hope you all enjoyed the meal. And your applause is for Lyle and Karen over here who had their own private date night at their own table. So thanks, Lyle and Karen. Much appreciated. So we'll begin with our guests tonight, and our first one is Chairman Ken Sealing. And so, Ken, would you like to say a few words?
Well, thanks, Mark, and it's always wonderful to be back here again. I've sort of lost track of how many times I've been out, very few years that I've missed, and probably I actually started coming out while I was still the mayor of Woolwich. And I remember actually my very first meeting, dinner meeting with the Federation. Some of you were probably there, and I was like the, I wasn't a welcome guest because I was leading the charge to get rid of retirement severances. Do you remember retirement severances? And some people were not too happy with that, but the irony of it was that ultimately the Federation became one of the strongest supporters of that policy once it got going, and so we're very much on side, and I've really enjoyed over the years the relationship with the Federation. It's been great. And I think maybe not contrary, but not in the same sort of setting, we as a region have worked together, the Federation, as partners through all of this and through all of our planning and through our growth management studies and our strategies and moving ahead. And the Federation has been an important part of that and a very, very positive and active player. And for that, I want to say a sincere thank you. It's been great to have that. I've enjoyed the association. I can tell you that about 3 weeks from now, my Holsteins will be moving out of the Reedelgen Chair's office, along with the Master Breeder Shield that belonged to my grandfather, and there'll be a new regional chair in place by the 1st of December. But I've always felt fairly rooted in the agricultural community and supporting the agricultural community and supporting agriculture generally throughout all of our planning and all that we've done. Because we have, people tend to forget, we talk about the high-tech industry, we talk about the insurance industry, but a lot of people don't really realize or appreciate the fact that agriculture is still one of the major mainstays of the regional economy here in the region of Waterloo. And that's why it's so very important that we protect it and work with it. So just keep up the good work. I just have two bits of advice to you as I leave. One is I was reading the rather interesting description of following the high-speed rail debate on the back of your program there. I would say keep an open mind throughout all of the discussions and keep tuned and keep an open mind to things. Some of these things are important to us. And secondly, I would say that I spent the day working with, at a session today with I call it my professional development day, and it's a group of planners and developers from across the province at the University of Waterloo, and the topic today was the growth management, the places to grow, and the Greenbelt legislation. And although we think that's very firmly rooted, I would say you need to keep a watching brief. We have a government in place that turns on a dime. And you heard some hints early on the campaign that they might be prepared to open it, which they quickly retracted. But I think we need to always be vigilant that the Places to Grow legislation remains strong and our plan remains in place. I'm just going to expand just a little bit. You may have heard over the last little while some efforts by groups to have the region included in the Greenbelt legislation. And so far we've resisted. And I have to tell you the reason we've resisted. And that is because the Greenbelt legislation is weaker than our official plan. And until the province of Ontario guarantees us that they will recognize the stronger of the two policies, we're not prepared to go into legislation because they can change legislation in Toronto on a dime and you'll never know what happened to you. So it's really important that you keep attuned to this and watch what's going on. Stay vigilant and continue to be good partners with the region. And I just want to say once again, thank you for your hospitality over the years and thank you for all the cooperation. Thanks very much.
And if I might say a few words, Ken, about you. We have been very lucky in Waterloo Region to have a culture of the appreciation of farmland and appreciation of rural culture and appreciation of the rural landscape and an appreciation of farmers. And that kind of culture starts at the top. And Ken, that in good part started with you. And that's much appreciated, and we remember things like that. When people question me when I say we have had great planning in Waterloo Region and a great chair, I say, if we had not, we might look, and we had the same densities in our urban footprint as do places like Denver or Dallas or Atlanta or Charlotte or you name the American city. We would have an urban footprint in Waterloo of Kitchener, Waterloo, and Cambridge that covered all five townships and an additional two. The reason we still exist is because we have a culture here in Waterloo Region of appreciating both urban and rural, and that's why we're still here. So we shouldn't forget that because it's a good thing, and we hope that that culture continues. And secondly, Ken, I read in the paper that, in your article about your retirement, that you did not have a hobby, and you confirmed that at the table tonight. And probably one should have a hobby when one is retired. One of the things that I do is I collect old glass insulators, you know, the telephone insulators and the telegraph insulators and the hydro insulators that used to be on the telephone line. So I'm going to give you a gift, if I may, kind of to provoke you into considering developing a hobby. So there are two old glass insulators, and you can put those in your window, and when the sun shines through them, you can remember that there are farmers in Waterloo Region and they produce food. How's that? Thank you very much. Our next guest is the mayor of Wilmot Township, Les Armstrong. And Les, would you please come and say a few words?
Thanks, Mark. Well, first of all, I want to echo some of your words and thank Ken for his leadership. I've only been at the table for 8 years, but I've come to know the steady leadership that you've held those 8 years and prior. And I also acknowledge how much the Regional Council has supported the Countryside Line, as Mark was talking about, and appreciate that. Since the inception of the region, it's been very strong to hold that line. So thank you very much for all your hard work, all your 33 years, and I hope your grandkids can learn what you look like. And I want to thank the Federation for the hard work that you do and the fact that you supply us all with what we need to survive. And it's such a strong Federation here in the Waterloo Region. And thank you very much and keep up the good work. And thank you for the great meal. It was fantastic, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
In the spirit of reflection, which appears to be what has happened here for the last couple minutes, I want to recognize someone who has probably attended more Federation annual meetings than anybody else, and probably the oldest person in this room. and that's Annie Kober. And Annie, that's a good thing, and it's a wonderful thing, and I'm sure you don't necessarily need a new hobby, but I'm going to do the same thing I did to Ken and give you an insulator and say thank you for coming and thank you for being a supporter of agriculture in Waterloo. And that's for you. Now I'm going to call on John Drummond. John, are you here? I hope you're here. From 4-H, and you have a presentation? Please go ahead.
So, thank you very much, and thank you again for the invitation to be here to update you on what's been going on with 4-H in Waterloo County. I always look forward to this. We've had a lot of really interesting stuff going on in the area of agriculture. Again, we've had four dairy clubs running in the county, a beef club, two sheep clubs, two veterinary clubs now, so that's been exciting. And then, of course, an agriculture awareness club that's running right here in New Hamburg area. In the area of food clubs, we had a new club start up, and it was called Farm to Table. All right, and it's a pilot project, but kids are learning about growing food, developing new products, marketing those products as well. So, and then on Saturday, we're starting the Kitchener Market 4-H Club again, which is a cooking club that happens right at the Kitchener Farmers Market on Saturday mornings. So it's been great for drawing urban kids into the 4-H program. And if you do know of any of those urban kids, make sure they know about this club. In the area of health, we've had clubs that encourage physical activity like paintball and line dancing, so those have been running well. Now, in the arts area, we've got quilting, photography, and craft clubs that run. And we do have some new clubs coming up to watch out for as well. So there's going to be a fishing club starting next year, an extreme sports club. There's a computer club running right now that's been going fairly well too. So I do want to give a very heartfelt thanks to the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture for the support that you give us. We could not put on the quality 4-H program that we do without your support. So thank you so much. So something new has happened over the last 2 or 3 years, and we've had a number of young leaders come on, recent graduates from the program that have picked up the ball and become 4-H club leaders. That's been wonderful to see. That being said, we're always looking for more. So if you're ever looking for a hobby, Ken, we can always use a new 4-H club. And I want you to know that it's not difficult. It's not a daunting task. It's always rewarding. And in fact, I always say I'm having the time of my life right now, and it's because of 4-H. So don't ever be afraid to step up and become a 4-H volunteer. And of course, if you know any young people aged 9 to 21, let them know about the 4-H program too. Every young person would benefit from this program. Direct them to our website, www.waterloo4-h.ca. The more the merrier. We want this program to be experienced by as many young people as possible and as many volunteers as possible. So, once again, thank you very much to all of you for the support that you give us.
Thank you, John. Another organization that the Waterloo Federation supports is Rural Women. And tonight we have Donna Rogers and Susan Martin. Are they here? Thank you. If you have a presentation, please come on up.
Okay, Donna put together a short video for us. This year, Farm Safety Day was June the 5th at Milky Wave. And many of you know Milky Wave, if you've been following the Canadian Milk Tour. So this has been a little harder event for us to maybe talk about tonight. We lost Bettina this summer, as you know, but her and Hank were a fabulous, fabulous host for us, Waterloo Rural Women. We certainly appreciate the help that we got from the Federation to help us put on events throughout the year. Our Farm Safety Day is one of those days. We have several others as well. Donna maybe talk about them after. We had about 120 kids that day, 40 to 50 volunteers, and we just had a lot of fun.
Hearing none, I'll just turn on my mic. Sorry. Excuse me. Oh, it went off. Hearing no comments or questions, I'll call the vote. Fred. Yes, it does. Everything. It includes everything that is in this book, if that's okay. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Anyone opposed? And it's carried. Thank you very much. And now I'll call on Gord to run the OFA portion of the meeting.
Thank you, Mark. Actually, is it working? Actually, we're going to continue with the WFA portion for just a little bit. And I was just thinking, as Mark was giving out these insulators, you know, good people are a lot like insulators in that they direct the flow of energy to the right place, and they stop a lot of sparks and conflict. So whether their endeavor is in politics or working hard in the community, all you good people are real good insulators. So we're going to get through a couple of different things, a couple of meetings real quickly. The nominating committee has gotten together again, not particularly creative. They seem to like to stay in the same path. So we have nominated for president Ken Hunsberger, vice president Mark Reeser. Ken, Mark, will you allow your names to stand? Okay. I'll open the floor to any other nominations. Fred asked, so I better show it just to prove to Fred. We've been through a lot of democracy this week, but we can still continue on. I have my my honey bucket / election kit here with pencils that have been sharp now for a number of years. I know that to be true because they weren't used often. So I'll call a second time for any other nominations. Third and final call then, I'll close nominations and we will acclaim Ken and Mark to their positions again. Thank you, gentlemen. For directors, we have Fred Wagner, Dennis Hahn, Don Stroh, Roland Kober, Craig Schatz, Brian Howling, Jeff Steger, and you'll notice there's some question marks. So if you don't want to dull my pencils, you could still nominate three more people here yet this evening who could be acclaimed. So on that note, I should say all those who have got their names there, will you allow your names to stand? Or I guess if you won't allow your names to stand, will you let me know? Okay. I'll open the floor for any other nominations. I'll put out a second call for further nominations. Third and final call then, I will close nominations and acclaim these directors. And as I do most years, I'll let you know that we do have a clause in the WFA Constitution that if somebody does show an interest and there are vacancies, and we have three vacancies as you can see, the board with a two-thirds vote can vote somebody in to those vacancies until the next annual general meeting. So. If you can just suddenly think of somebody to be really good on the way home, send them out to a meeting. You can tell them why you're sending them or not. I'll leave that up to you. So we do need to have a motion as well, Richard, I believe, to have Pauline Kober and John Good perform the duty of financial examiners for the upcoming year. Can I get somebody to approve that motion? Okay. Second? Fred Wagner? All those in favor? Any opposed? Carried. And I do like to make a special mention. Mark wears a number of different hats. He was not only acclaimed as vice president here tonight, but he was acclaimed to his position as a director for OFA covering Waterloo, Wellington, and Dufferin. Now, and at each meeting, he kind of says that federation's his favorite, but for different reasons. So he's not, not being dishonest. So thank you, Mark, for all the work you do. Mark was in Niagara on the Lake and got back here in time for a wonderful meal here with us. And, of course, Richard Cressman and Susan for all the work that they do in the year keeping things straight. Thank you very much. So we'll move on quickly to another meeting and get that out of the way. The OFA regional meeting is where you have an opportunity to elect your policy advisory counselor. So once a long time ago, OFA was huge. It had a board of over 100 people, and now it has a board of 18 people, but it has policy advisory counselors from all over the province that perform a lot of the stuff that the larger board would have been involved yet, and they provide insights to the OFA directors as they develop policy. So your current PAC person and the person nominated for the upcoming year is Jeff Steger. The bylaws do allow for an alternate to take Jeff's place if he can't make it. Craig Martin, who couldn't be here tonight because he's getting those last few loads of beans out of the field, was what he had emailed me about earlier this evening, has agreed to also allow his name stand as alternate. So that said, I'll open the floor to any other nominations. Second call. Third and final call then, and I will close the nominations and acclaim Jeff as your policy advisory council for next year, and Craig as our backup. This year we need six convention delegates from Waterloo, and we're going to meet somewhere else this year. Things have changed along the airport strip, and it's becoming much easier. And we're hoping the Hamilton Convention Center will be a better venue. And I think those at Lake Country and Western, that's a much better place to be. Isn't that kind of the center of Country and Western in Ontario? So bring your boots and, get your line dancing technique down. Because prosperity is going to grow here. And I thought tonight actually prosperity might have grown here a little as well too, right? So. So that'll be the 19th and 20th of November convention delegates. Sorry, three. I'm already working on tomorrow night's meeting in Wellington where we appoint six. Waterloo is three. And so we have Ken Hunsberger, Craig Shantz, Fred Wagner nominated to go, and Brian Howling as an alternate to fill in if something happens and one of our three can't go. Those three gentlemen, I don't know if Brian was here in the crowd, I didn't see him. You'll allow your names to stand. I see some nods. Yeah, I think I see nods. I'll open the floor to any further nominations. Second call. Third and final call, then I will close nominations and acclaim these as your people that will go on to Hamilton Convention Center and participate in OFA's annual general meeting. And that brings our business session to the end. And I think, Mark, you're going to have somebody come up and just provide us some transition as we get over to our speaker.
Thank you, Gord, if you want to get ready. I just want to say two things before we begin. One, I want to thank Jeff Steger. Jeff, if you don't know it, has a weekly one-hour radio show called the Agriculture Show. Jeff, what are the call letters of your station? CKMS. And Jeff manages to get the most eclectic collection of guests that you can imagine. And it's a great one-hour show just to listen to and be entertained and informed. Thanks for doing that, Jeff. Secondly, make a comment about organizations and who we thank and who we recognize. We often recognize the leader, and rightly so. Sometimes we forget about the people who actually do the work. And one of those people at GRCA is Ann Leffler. And while we all appreciate, or we can appreciate, what GRCA does, Ann Leffler is one of the people who actually does stuff. She's the person who meets farmers. She's the one who does the work. And you're turning red, but that's okay. And I just want to recognize what she does. And I'm going to ask her to come up and just say just a couple of words, Ann, about what you do.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks to the Federation for inviting me for a great dinner. Yeah, Mark's right. I do stuff. I have a great job. I get to work with the farmers, in mostly the farmers in the Waterloo region, but also in Wellington County and Dufferin to some extent. I'm going to take a step back and just thank the region at this point. The region of Waterloo has given the Rural Water Quality Program $350,000 per year for 21 years. There is no such thing in the rest of Canada, a program that's run for 21 years. The amount of momentum we can get going with the farming community on a program that exists from year to year, that's just incredible. So when I look around the room, I recognize so many of you. It's been such a pleasure to work with all of you. Mark didn't tell me he was going to give me the mic, so I can't wow you with any figures or anything, but just a little story for you. I was near Boomer Creek, near St. Clements the other day, and trying to check up on some trees that I knew we'd planted. I don't remember, was it 10 or 15 years ago? I knew they were down by the creek behind the fence. I couldn't see them because there was all these really, really tall trees in the way. Duh. That's our trees. These trees that have been funded by the region to help protect water quality are now really, really making a huge difference on the landscape. And now these days when we turn around, I know I was talking to a few other people in the room here earlier, the landscape has really changed. And because of the support of the region, the Conservation Authority has been able to work with so many farmers in doing voluntary projects to protect water quality. And they keep on giving us the funding every year. So I did bring my display. I've got some grant information here. If anyone's interested in the grants for the cover crops, I actually brought the application forms because we know there's a lot of interest in that. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Anne, for doing stuff. And another great example of Waterloo's history of working together, rural and urban. So we've come to our time for our special guest, and his name is Wendell Shum. And Wendell works for Wallenstein Feeds, and as I understand it, what else he does is something in social media. And we in agriculture tend not to be very good at that sometimes. And so we need people like Jeff and like Wendell to show us the way and portray agriculture in a good light. And I won't say any more than that. I'll let Wendell introduce himself. So Wendell, welcome, and thanks for coming.
Mike? Okay. Thanks, Sharon. Okay, we have to set up a computer. And that, Mark, was a good introduction. I appreciate that. I told him ahead of time, you know, he can introduce me however he likes. I have no real idea how I want to be introduced. I usually let the person doing the introduction come up with that on their own. And I really should stop doing that because a couple of years ago, I was speaking for a Grain Farmers of Ontario group. See if that comes up. And I had a friend of mine, Steve McCabe, who works for Grain Farmers of Ontario, introducing me. And I told Steve what I often tell people. HDMI is just right at the back. Yeah. See? Something with social media does not include IT. Good, okay. So I told my friend Steve McCabe, sort of gave him the same instructions on introducing me, that I don't really care how he introduces me, as long as he makes it interesting. So Steve got up there and he said, our guest tonight is Wendell Shum. He said, Wendell is the first African-American woman to enter the space program and fly the space shuttle. So thank you for not only making it interesting, but making it factual as well. Okay, so that worked. So that's good. Perfect. Good. Okay. So, something in social media. So in my day job, as Mark said, I do work at Wallenstein Feeds. I manage a sales division there. And I am also, involved in social media. I'm active online. I do a podcast. Who knows what a podcast is, for starters? Okay, that's not super encouraging. who knows what a radio show is? Right, better. Okay, a podcast is much like a radio show, except you can listen to it anytime you want on your computer. So just one step up. I do like people to understand kind of that I'm not an expert in this stuff. The fact that I do it shouldn't suggest to anybody that I know more than other people about doing this stuff. So let's do a little show of hands again. Who here is on Twitter? Okay, that's not too bad. Okay. Who's on Facebook? Yeah, there's always a few more hands for Facebook. Everybody has a cell phone? Yeah? Okay, smartphones. Okay, this is where I'm gauging the audience now to get a bit of an idea in terms of where we rank in technology because, you know, as far as technology goes, I've seen a lot of technology. You know, I remember, let's do a fun game here. Who remembers, before we had cell phones? Yeah, a lot of people. Okay. Who remembers, before cable TV when you had to adjust the antenna on the TV? Okay. Who remembers rotary dial party line telephones? Right, okay. Who has had to ask their neighbor to get off the party line telephone because they had to order bull semen? Just me on that one? No, there's not just me. I knew this crowd would be good. Okay. All right, so I speak to a number of groups, and some of the groups I speak to are quite a bit younger than I am, and then they usually judge what I'm wearing, and they gauge sort of how lame I am based on how bad I am at some of the social media stuff. I don't feel like that's going to be a problem with this crowd tonight. Okay. So when I talk to groups about social media, I think that what they expect is something like this. They expect someone who's sort of young and hip and they're really into, things like, weaving, and they're into sort of handmade kind of stuff and artsy kind of things. I think one of them, is probably, political science major up there. So when you show up to a meeting that you've been invited to and you're going to hear somebody talk about social media and you picture this and you get this, that's what you're getting with me tonight. And I think that's what a lot of us are at, struggling with technology, but making an effort. And so I probably am even worse than somebody who doesn't know anything about technology because I think I know about technology. And so I've always been that way. And when cell phones first came out, I was an early adopter of texting. And our kids who are, we have one teenager and two that are in their 20s now, but we did a cool thing with them one year when
instead of writing letters to Santa Claus, we let them text their letters to Santa Claus. And so then they would text their letters, and of course, it wasn't really going to Santa Claus, it was coming to us. And then we would reply with a text back, and they got this cool text back. So it all went really, really good until our youngest, you know, texted her letter to Santa, and I replied with it, and I said, you know, okay, I'm Julia, I'm really looking forward to coming to your house Christmas Eve, and I'm going to bring you the doll that you asked for, so you can look forward to me coming down your chimney. All the best, Satan. So that's when I learned that auto-text, auto-correct, can ruin Christmas, and that was also an integral part of technology. So that's where I'm at when it comes to technology. In terms of being on social media and talking about what happens on farms and within agriculture, we know that consumers want to hear from people like farmers, they want to hear from vets, they want to hear from moms. The whole mom scientist category is a big group. I don't check any of those boxes. I'm not a farmer. I'm not a mom. I don't really fit the mold of somebody that we would say, you should be talking to consumers about agriculture. You're a credible source for agriculture. Because the bottom line is, I'm not a farmer. That doesn't mean I didn't plan on being a farmer. So this is cute little Wendell here in the back of the wagon. I grew up on a farm on the 16th line next to the East Aurora Mennonite Church. Anybody know where that is? Okay, so when I got to be a teenager and I would go to dances either in Tavistock or New Hamburg, I got beat up at both. So this is me when I was a little kid, you know, wanting to be a farmer. Everything was about growing up and being a farmer. And I was, you don't know if you can see this is my Bible that I'm holding right there. So I was a good little typical Mennonite kid. Then I got to be a teenager, and I was not. So when I got to be a teenager, still thinking that I want to be a farmer, I didn't always see eye to eye with my father. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. Anybody's got sons? Anybody's got a father? They maybe can. And it was sort of suggested rather strongly that I should probably get off the farm for a couple of years. I should go to college and see what else is out there. You know, try something new, get a bit of perspective, then come home and farm. So that's what I did. Grudgingly went off the farm, went to college, you know, learned a few things different than what we did at home, and with the intention of coming back and farming someday. So it was a real eye-opener for me. Mennonite kid from a farm, you know, next to the East Aurora Mennonite Church, going off to Centralia College, you know, 300 students. That was a big change. So I came home, I remember the first, might not have been the first weekend, might have been a couple of weeks in, I came home and I said, did you know you can castrate pigs as babies? We had never done that. This would have been, yeah, just about 1990. Any pig farmers here? Okay, so no pig farmers at all? Wow, okay. Well then I can tell you whatever story I want about pigs probably and you won't know. When I was a kid growing up, we milked cows and we had 65 sows, farrow to finish. We castrated pigs, taking them off the wiener deck, putting them into the finishing barn. The pig weighs 55 pounds when you're taking it off the wiener deck. We used to put their heads in a pail, and you'd hold them, and it was like holding a jackhammer. And I went to college and learned that you can castrate pigs as babies holding them like this. So I came home and said, that's amazing. I learned something new. So I had all this newfound knowledge, and I don't know if anybody knows this, but when you, at 18 or 19, go away and come home and start telling your dad how things are done, they don't always want to do it that way. So I didn't come back home right after college. You know, I had to go get a job, get off the farm, and go see how things were done in the outside world, cut my teeth somewhere else a little bit, and I did that. I went and got a job selling feed for a co-op in those days. Anybody that's in, John, you're in the feed industry, did you ever work for the co-op? You might be the first person I've run into in the feed industry that didn't start with the co-op or work for the co-op at one time. So as I started in this career working with farmers but not being on farm, you know, that stubbornness that I had as a teenager turned into perseverance. And it was one of those things where I was actually pretty good at what I was doing. But as I was doing it, I had every intention of still going back home and taking over the family dairy farm and milking cows. So in my mind, I was selling feed, but I was a farmer. So there's that sort of personal identity that I had. This was a part-time gig. This was something that I was going to do until I could afford to get back home and go back farming again. Oops. Okay, so let's see. I started selling feed when I was 21. I got a good early start, and I did this for a few years. Once I got good at it, I got some opportunities, and at 26, I had to make a choice because I got approached by a couple other real smart guys. Well, I got approached by a couple real smart guys. I shouldn't assume anything by saying a couple other real smart guys. They were real smart. And they asked me to start a new feed company. So at 26 years of age, with almost no life experience at all, I had to make the choice of either go home, be a farmer, or take this, what was really a great opportunity, and make the decision to go into what I considered ag industry and never go back and be a farmer. So even though they were both good choices, it was a difficult decision for me because the farm that I grew up on, you know, was five generations, you know, and if I didn't go home and take over the farm, I'm going to be the generation that lets that farm go out of the family. So it was not something that was easy, but, you know, had conversations with my wife and my parents, and we talked about it, and I made the decision not to go back and farm, and I became someone who was involved in ag industry. So at this point, I started to view myself no longer as a farmer, and I started to think of myself as more of a business professional. And that shift is something that, you know, I wouldn't have even really thought about it much at the time, but if I walked into a room and there was a group of farmers that were talking about farm issues, I would not probably feel comfortable going and joining with those farmers to talk about those issues because I was no longer part of that select group. So there was a whole debate that I was having with myself that if I got too involved in farm discussions, that people would think I'm pretending to be a farmer and that I would be an imposter and that somehow wouldn't be, it wouldn't be sincere and I would be seen as an imposter. And I got this chip on my shoulder a little bit about that. So anyway, that's where I went with my career instead of going back home and farming. So we ran that business for 10 years really successfully, did a great job. It was the right decision for me for sure, but I never did quite lose that, you know, regret a little bit that I was not ever going to be a farmer. But I really enjoyed what I was doing. And so after running that business for 10 years, we sold that business to Wallenstein Feeds, where I work today. And so here I was, not a farmer, a business professional, wasn't yet 40, you know, had had some measure of success, you know, had accomplished really a lot of the goals that I had set for myself by that stage. And so I had intended that I would go work for Wallenstein Feeds and continue down that path of business. And I associated myself, the volunteer stuff that I did, you know, I did more in the business vein as opposed to in agriculture. I volunteered, you know, with the Accelerator Center in Waterloo. I did some early stage tech investing things. I was playing more in that field. Even though my full-time day job was still in agriculture, I was getting more and more involved in things outside of agriculture. And so at this point, you know, I was agriculture, you know, paid all of the bills. Agriculture was what kept our family going, but I wasn't really connected with agriculture in the way that I would if I was a farmer. So sometimes things happen and when you're thinking that you've got everything planned. And so for me, like I said, I accomplished a lot of the goals I had set for myself, and I had a real plan in place. I had this good job working for a great company, you know, and I was doing some of these other projects on the side. And for me, everything was sort of right on track. And then life sometimes has a way of throwing things at you when you least expect it and letting you know that you're not in quite as much control as you thought you were. So for me, after having all of this success, you know, at the age of 37, the thing that did that for me was I had a stroke. And it was ironic because I was probably in the best shape of my life at 37. I had taken up kickboxing. We had a club here in town, taught the kids. And it was part of that training. You know, I was working out with my trainer at the gym one morning, and it was a fluke thing. I tore an artery in my neck, and a blood clot formed. And then when that blood clot let loose, I had a classic right side paralysis stroke. And so that's the kind of thing that makes you stop and step back. I was at the hospital, and I was sort of taking stock. The thing they don't tell you, well, they don't tell you until you have a stroke. It changes your life. You had a minor stroke, and mine would have been considered relatively minor, and they know a lot more about this kind of a stroke now. This is considered an athlete stroke. You hear about this with hockey players now, and you hear about this with athletes because it is that artery that tears in your neck. But having a stroke makes you extremely emotional, and nobody told me that. And so I was at Victoria Hospital in Kitchener, and it's a teaching hospital. And so I had just been taken for an MRI, and there was nobody there visiting me at the time, and so I was laying in my hospital bed, you know, my gown open kind of at the back, and feeling sorry for myself, having a little cry. And the doctor brought in, you know, six student doctors and said, Mr. Shum, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I think so. He said, well, we're going to send you home today. Is that all right with you? And I said, well, okay, I guess I can go home. So the thing that I realized when I was at home recuperating, you know, in a dark room, in the quiet for 2 weeks, was that the things I cared about wasn't the business stuff. It wasn't the tech stuff. It was the people that reached out to me from the agricultural community. You know, and that's when I kind of realized that even though I wasn't a farmer, you know, I cared about agriculture, and it was something that I really believed in. So for me, that was a turning point in my life, and I started to maybe rethink the way that I looked at certain things, not just about agriculture, but the way I approached certain things in life. And one of the things that I realized was that you can't do things that people tell you are the right things to do. Because when I had a stroke, I had up to that point been very certain about the direction my life was going, and I thought I had it all planned out, and I thought I was really in control. The other thing they don't tell you about having a stroke is you become very uncertain about yourself, and you start to question a lot of things that you thought were true. And so I started to, instead of make decisions for myself, I started to listen to a lot of people that told me the way that I should do things, and, you know, kind of went along with what they were telling me. And one of those things, because I had been training, I mentioned I was training in kickboxing at this point. Well, of course, you have a traumatic head injury like that. The first thing doctors tell you is, well, you're not going to do that again. Like, you're not going back. Taking shots to the head are not a good idea, which, of course, that made sense to me. So when the first doctor told me that, I was disappointed, but I thought, well, that makes some sense. And so by the time sort of the third doctor that I went to see had told me, well, you're not, probably never going to do kickboxing again, I was sort of feeling down about that. And then a sports medicine doctor at the Waterloo Sports Medicine Clinic said, well, ask the doctor, go ask a neurologist that tells you not to do it. Ask him what advice he would give someone, you know, who never had a traumatic head injury. So I did. I said, so if I shouldn't go back and do a sport that, you know, could get me punched in the face, what would you tell somebody that had never had any kind of a traumatic head injury? He said, I'd tell him the same thing. He said, it's got nothing to do with the fact that you've had a stroke. He said, that's a terrible idea, and it's not something that anybody should do. So it wasn't a fact that I had had a stroke. He was passing his own personal judgment on what was smart and what was a good thing to do onto me. So I said, okay, fine. We're going to go back and do that. So I finally found a neurologist that would clear me to go back and compete in full contact kickboxing. Then I just had to convince my wife. So we had set a goal, and so we had a club here in town. I live in New Hamburg, by the way. I probably should have mentioned that. And we trained kids for kickboxing and sent them all over the world and competed for Team Canada in kickboxing. And so I had set a goal for myself that I wanted to try and compete at that level. And so I talked it over with my wife, Jennifer, and she, you know, didn't feel great about it. So, because it's been 6 months since I had a stroke. And she said, okay. She said, let's ease into it and try it. And she said, please try not to get hit in the head. So, yeah. I don't know if you know this about kickboxing. Contact sports are different than any other kind of sport. In kickboxing or in boxing, if you play basketball and you go play basketball, and if you play good and you win, great. And if you don't, you lose. With contact sports, if you do well and you win, great. And if you lose, you get beat up. That's the way that works. So I got punched in the face a lot. And I learned from doing this that you're not going to be good at things right away. And that's true in whether it's in kickboxing, whether it's true in sports, or whether it's true in life. If you're going to do something and you're going to commit to it, you're going to have to get punched in the face a lot before you're really good at that. That's me 4 years later. So I competed for the Canadian kickboxing team internationally 4 years. That was my best finish in Ireland. I finished second in the world in my weight class and age group. Don't anybody ask me what my age group is, please. And I would never have done that if I had listened to the doctors that told me that I shouldn't be competing in kickboxing, not because I had a stroke, but because that doctor didn't think that that was a smart thing for someone to do. So you have to make those decisions for yourself. You have to commit to something, and just because other people don't necessarily agree doesn't mean that you don't make that decision. Okay, that's about me. This is the part about agriculture. So at this point, I guess, this is about 2015, and social media is just a thing. I was not on social media in 2015 other than a Facebook account, I guess. Maybe had a Facebook account. And I was not really involved in any of the conversations about agriculture much. And I went to a farm and food care event, and there were three speakers on a panel. This is Sarah Schultz. She's a nurse and a grain farmer out in Western Canada. Carrie Mess, Dairy Carrie, is a dairy farmer from Wisconsin. And Andrew Campbell, lots of people will know who Andrew Campbell is. They were on a speaker panel, and they talked that day about speaking up for agriculture and you know, bridging the gap between farmers and the urban consumers, that we needed to do more and have those conversations because, you know, people were making decisions about where their food comes from. And so I thought, okay, let's get involved. Because some really smart people have done this work, and they tell us this, that public trust, we are losing public trust in the way that we grow their food. Numbers are still high. People still generally think a lot of farmers. But we know that consumers are way more concerned about animal welfare. Consumers are demanding food safety. They care about the environment. And they're definitely conscious of the medication that we administer. This is some stuff that was done by the Canadian Center for Food Integrity. Again, smart group. You know, they went and polled a bunch of consumers, and they asked them about their attitudes towards farming. And some of these are fairly reasonable, and you would expect that they would come out with these answers. You know, I'm personally concerned about drug residues in meat, milk, and eggs, sure. You know, I am concerned about the affordability of healthy food than I was a year ago. Everybody's more concerned about where their dollars go. That one makes sense. I am personally concerned about eating food that comes from genetically engineered crops. 41, almost one out of two people say they're concerned about eating food that comes from genetically engineered crops. Do you know how many, like, what genetically engineered crops are? Everything. We're not talking GMOs. Genetical engineering, we've bred crops to be a certain way. There's nothing that we eat or that we grow that exists the way that it did in nature. So everything is technically genetically engineered. Canadian farmers are good stewards of the environment. You know, OFA, Waterloo Federation of Agriculture, you know, they put a lot of effort into making sure that we're good stewards of the environment. One out of three Canadians agrees with that statement. One out of three consumers thinks that farmers are good stewards of the environment. We're getting into some alarming kind of stuff here. Then we get into the real weird stuff. Videos of farm animals being treated poorly are not representative of normal livestock farming practices. So when you see a video online of somebody abusing an animal, you know, do you think that that is or is not? Only one out of three people would say that that's not representative of what happens. That means 2 out of 3 people think it is representative of what happens on livestock farms. Skip ahead of on a few of these things. Let's see. Animals should have the same rights as humans. Only 1 out of 4 people said that. But you got to keep in mind what that statement is saying. Not animals should have rights. Animals should have the same rights as humans. So that means 1 out of 4 Canadians believes that animals should be treated the same way as you and I are treated and should have the same rights. You know, trust the Canadian, the government food inspection system. Canadian food is among the most affordable. Only 1 out of 10 people thinks that Canadian food is amongst the most affordable food in the world. These are numbers that are alarming, and they're getting worse. You know, so getting involved is not so much a question or something fun to do. We have to be having some of these conversations or else we're losing these battles. Okay, so Andrew Campbell. Who knows who Andrew Campbell is? Right. Dairy farmer from down in, not Middlesex, down that way. Andrew did the Farm 365 a couple of years ago where he took a picture of his farm and then he put it on social media for people to see in hashtag,
it's a pound sign.
And that's how, if you want to search something on social media, you would search for a hashtag. And so he did that and encouraged other farmers to do that and put pictures of their farm, open the barn doors, so to speak, so that consumers could see what we were doing on our farms and sort of make it less secretive and sort of bridge that communication gap. So when he did that, he got a great response. News media picked it up. It got all over the world. You know, it really became a big thing. The other people that caught on to what Andrew was doing were activists, people that don't want us to do the kind of farming that we do. They don't want animal agriculture. They don't want us to have conventional crops. They really want to change the way that we farm. And they attacked what he was doing online. And for me, because I know Andrew and I know what kind of a person he is, it wasn't so much what he was doing that urged me into some kind of action. It was the way he was being attacked and the way the activists were changing a good thing that he was doing and making it something, nasty. That's what really got me involved. So, I put this picture up here sort of in homage to Jeff Stager because I know Jeff will appreciate the hat. Okay, thanks, Dave. These are the things that I started to fight with people online. I got on Twitter, and you know, you're not supposed to pick fights on Twitter. I picked all the fights. You know, I argued with the activists, and I couldn't help myself. You know, some of the things that are out there, GMOs are evil. You know, that was a big one for me. A vegetarian diet is more humane. So people that think that, you know, if you eat a vegetarian diet, it means animals are going to, less animals have to die in order for you to eat. And I mean, again, that one, just because you don't see it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. You know, producing meat, having a slaughterhouse, it's in your face. There's no way to hide the fact that an animal dies so you can put meat on your plate. It's way easier with a vegetarian diet not to think about the animals that are dying. But that doesn't mean they're not dying. You know, you have to control pests. You have to keep the rabbits out of your lettuce. You know, you're not sending that rabbit to a spa. That animal is, you know, we're taking resources away in order to have the food that we want. And consumers more, if they don't have to think about it and they don't have to see it, that means it's not happening. Animal agriculture is bad for the planet. My kids went to school at Rockaway and Kitchener. And our daughter came home from Rockaway one day, and in her environmental studies class, she said that her teacher, her science teacher, offered them science teacher, so someone educated in science, offered them extra credit if they would stop eating meat one day a week because it's better for the planet. They're teaching our kids this stuff in school as fact. Animals are happier in the wild than on farms. This is a big one I get, and I get this from people that won't eat meat that's raised on farms. They'll only eat meat that they hunt themselves because somehow that animal lived a happier life and, you know, was in its natural environment. Well, I don't know if anybody knows what happens to animals in the wild if they get sick or if they get chased by predators. But on farms, we're required to give animals a certain level of care. And we provide shelter, we provide good food and nutrition, and we provide medicine and vet care if they get sick. So if we tried to treat animals on farms the way that we expect them to live in the wild, they'd get taken away from us and we'd go to jail. And that's what people don't seem to realize when they want to talk about how animals are somehow happier in the wild. It's because we keep animals for food. They can't get past the fact that that animal's going to have a good life on a farm, but at the end, we're going to whack it over the head and we're going to put it on the plate. So this is where the misconception comes into it. And then this idea of hormone-free. And this one's a hot button issue for me because I'm a strong supporter on the dairy side, you know, in this last trade deal, has me a little bit worked up. And we want people to buy Canadian milk. So I agree with that, 100%. Buy Canadian. I do not agree when we start talking about how American milk is loaded with hormones. All milk has hormones. All food has hormones. Hormones are a part of life, and they're in everything that we have. Same as chemicals. You can't go chemical-free. Everything's made up of chemicals. So when people get selective about, you know, hormone-free, chemical-free, that kind of stuff, we need to do a better job of having those conversations. Okay, so these are the people that I got involved with. And I learned lesson one of, you know, having effective conversations with consumers. Don't try and fight the fights with people that don't want to listen. You're not going to reason with the unreasonable. You're not going to convince some people that what we're doing is okay. Leave them alone. Because it isn't those people that we can move. There's 5% of the population is on one side. They don't care what you've got to say. You're never going to change their mind. Probably any more than they're going to change my mind about, you know, animal agriculture. But there's 90% of the people in the middle. Those people are watching the conversations. They're following along on social media. Those are the people we want to be trying to reach. Okay, so Twitter. I learned a lot about Twitter in the early days. We've all learned a lot about Twitter since Donald Trump got in office, I think. And I have this is a sideline. I do sidelines sometimes. You guys did pretty good getting me this far without me going on a sideline. But I have come up with a theory on sort of why don't we view Donald Trump the way, other than the fact that he's a bit of a loose cannon. We have access to Donald Trump in a way that we've never had intimate access to any president before. We know every detail about his life. He could tweet us at 2 o'clock in the morning from the presidential bathroom. And we have that in real time. Think about if we had that kind of access to past presidents. Think about if Richard Nixon could be tweeting on his toilet at 2 in the morning. Can you imagine some of the stuff he would have tweeted out? What about John F. Kennedy, one of the greatest presidents of all time? Imagine if we knew all of the intimate details about someone like John F. Kennedy and what he did in his personal life. Would we remember him the same way as we remember him today? Probably not. So I think social media has changed the way that history is going to remember presidents. And for the record, I am not a Donald Trump fan. So don't shoot that at me on Twitter. Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. So I did the Twitter thing, and I realized that, you know, I wasn't having effective conversations with the consumers. So I did what everybody does when they have thoughts and they want to get them out there. I started a blog. And so my blog was called Old Enough to Know Better, because I'm clever, and I think that that's funny. And so I wrote about things that I care about. You know, I wrote about, animals on farms. I wrote about supply management. I wrote about protecting family farms. I wrote about lab meat. I wrote about all this stuff. And it was easy for me to write because I had all these ideas and I had all these opinions and wanted to get them out there. And once I had written, you know, a dozen or maybe 15 articles, I realized I didn't have anything else to say. I got all the stuff off my chest that was really good, but, you know, I got this blog and I putting that stuff out there. Nobody really gave me anything new to talk about. When I tried to write stuff that I didn't care about, it wasn't very good. So for me, and this is where I think there's people in the room that are actual journalists. Those people can write about things. They given a topic and they can write about it. To me, a blogger like myself is somebody that, if they care about something, they can put it on paper, but you can't give them a topic and ask them to write about it. So, a couple things happened at this point. This is where we get Jeff Stager involved a little bit. Jeff was not actually the first person to put me on the radio. I know Jeff is famous for putting people in agriculture on the radio. I had actually done some radio before Jeff put me on his show. This is a guy by the name of Trent Luce. Trent is a radio personality in the U.S. He is on syndicated radio, a number of different stations through the Midwest, and he's been doing this for probably 20 years. And this getup that you see Trent in with the hat and the scarf and the boots, that's not a costume. That's what he wears. He's a rancher from Nebraska, and he travels and does 200 speaking engagements a year to different groups, plus doing 4 daily radio shows in the U.S., and he wears that walking through airports in Chicago, Minnesota, New York, and he has conversations with consumers, and he came up and spoke at a meeting for us up in Bruce County to a bunch of beef farmers, and he talked about, I think the name of his talk that night was Crunchy Granola Moms, and some of the misconceptions that urban mothers have about how their food is grown, and I had to give him a ride back to the airport from Chesley, back to Pearson Airport in Toronto that night. And because he didn't have a radio program recorded for the next day, on the way back from Chesley to Toronto, we recorded my first ever radio show. So short of hitting or a near miss with somebody bicycling on one of the 4-lane highways in Toronto, it went pretty smooth. So that was my first foray into the radio business. And then I got invited to do Jeff's show in Kitchener. And this is my colleague, Christine Schoonerwood. She actually lined the whole thing up. And we went into Kitchener, you know, to do this radio show. And we had an impression of what we were getting ourselves into. We thought we were going to, you know, a radio building, and there was going to be a studio, and it was going to be people behind the board, and it was, you know, there was a whole setup. And, you know, this is what we thought radio was. And Jeff, I don't mean to like be disparaging here, but when we showed up at a warehouse and had to find the door to get into, Christine might not have been concerned about us getting mugged and killed that day, but it wasn't quite as high tech as we thought, and yet it was fun, and it turned out to be pretty good. So on the way back from doing Jeff's radio show, we talked about it and said, well, that was pretty cool. What if we do our own radio program, except we don't really, you know, have access to a radio station? So what if we do something that we put on our computer and we release it on Twitter and Facebook and that kind of stuff, and we'll see if people listen? So we literally picked up the phone, started calling people in agriculture and recording our conversations and putting them online. And people were interested. So that's how we came up with the concept of doing a podcast. Again, podcast, like a radio show. We record a conversation with someone in agriculture, still have my full-time job, this is a hobby, and we release that out on social media and people listen. So the early days were pretty rough. We didn't know much about editing. We didn't know much about sound quality. This was our recording studio. Jeff's did look a lot more professional than ours in those days. I don't know if you can tell. This is me sitting inside a cardboard box. Keep the sound contained. So that was our professional radio studio in the early days. We've come a little bit of a ways. When I say the early days, this is 2 years ago. This is not that long. Okay. So if some people, when they start a new project like this, they research it. They take some lessons, you know, they maybe read up on it, and they sort of get polished before they go. That's not what we did. We started and learned as we went, and we did about as many things wrong as you could do. We had to call guests back and re-record episodes because, you know, we thought we were recording, but we didn't actually get anything. We thought it was coming into the mic, but maybe instead of going into the right side of the mic, maybe we had the sound picking up from the wrong side. There was a lot of things we did wrong. So that would have been something that... if I could go back and there was another lesson there, don't underestimate the importance of quality. We actually picked up a fair following of people that would listen to the show early on, and when we put something out that was bad, people lost their minds, and we got lots of negative feedback. And the other thing on the heels of that is don't be afraid to ask for help. There was not a lot of people doing what we were doing even 2 years ago, certainly not in agriculture. There wasn't that many. And we didn't really know who to reach out to and talk to. And we would call people, and we would talk to different people in the industry, talk to lots of farmers, but we talked to people like David Emery was on the show. We talked about the history of agriculture, and David and I, you know, go back and forth a little bit now. Like, you know, there's a guy who was in radio in the early days. Timothy Caulfield is a scientist at the University of Alberta, and Timothy wrote a book called Why Gwyneth Paltrow is Wrong About Everything. And he debunks all of the pseudoscience myths and the fad kind of diets. One of the big ones that he was on when I had him on the podcast was when Gwyneth Paltrow was advocating the vagina steam. If you need more information on that, you can Google it. Timothy now has a show on Netflix called A User's Guide to Cheating Death. So if you have Netflix, search that one. It's quite interesting. He tries all of the fad stuff and debunks it. And then this one's coming out next week if you're interested. These guys are making vodka out of milk. Dairy distillery. So we might fix our trade problems with dairy if we can drink enough vodka. So we've talked to a lot of really, really interesting people as part of doing the show. And for me, that's one of the great things about doing it. I probably get as much out of doing the podcast as a lot of our listeners get. The network of people that I have connected with by doing this has been phenomenal. And I care much more about agriculture, and I feel connected to it because I'm going back and doing that. And the ladies had mentioned the Shermans. You know, I have known Hank and Bettina and the kids, and, you know, we have had them on the podcast. We promoted their Canadian Milk Tour before they left, and they literally, you know, did that on 10 days' notice, decided they were going to go do this. And so when Jim, Hank's oldest son, called me to the day that they had the accident and that Bettina was killed, he said, Wendell, he said, we need to deal with this. This is a tragedy, he said, and the news is calling, the media is calling. He said, can you handle that stuff for us? Can you just deflect these people and, you know, give us the time that we need? And so for me, doing the podcast, doing the stuff on social media, and being connected with the people in agriculture in a way that I haven't been connected really since I was at home on the farm has allowed me to give something back when people within that community need it. And, you know, I couldn't be more proud to call Hank a friend and to have done what little I did for them as a family. They're an amazing family. He's an amazing guy. And just to be able to be connected with that in some small way and help him and help that family when they needed the help, you know, that's the kind of thing that keeps me doing what I'm doing and just putting that out there. Incidentally, Hank then finished the trip in September, went out to the West Coast with the two girls, and then went out to the East Coast as well, has been to every province in Canada promoting Canadian dairy on the Canadian Milk Tour. And I'm pleased to say that on Monday, myself and Hank and the three boys have a meeting scheduled with Doug Ford and Ernie Hardiman, and we're going to also be meeting with Andrew Scheer at some point to get that message to them that Canadian dairy is important, and it's important to support family farms, you know, and the next generation of people on those farms. And that's something that Bettina wanted. You know, for her it was all about the family, and it was all about, you know, getting that message out. They believed in that, and so I really am proud and sort of humbled to be part of that, even a small part. The other thing that we've done is I connected with a couple of guys. This guy here is a corn and soybean farmer from Illinois. His name's Rob Sharkey. He has a podcast on the radio called the Shark Farmer Podcast. Tim Hamrich is an ag recruiter from Texas. He has a podcast called the Future of Agriculture Podcast. The three of us teamed up, I would say, a year and a half ago. It'll be 2 years in February, and we formed the first agricultural podcast network. So if you search for podcasts, the beautiful thing about podcasts is you can get into a topic that you're interested in, and you can go real deep. If you're interested in, you know, making ceramic sculptures, you can find a radio show about making ceramic sculptures. If you're into, you know, fine cigars, there's radio shows about fine cigars. But it's hard to find those. So when people are looking for real agriculture content, you know, and you search that on Google, you're going to get something about backyard farming, or you're going to get something about Kubota tractors. You know, you're not going to get the real kind of content. So we started this network, and it was the three of our podcasts, and then we've added some new podcasts to it over time. So in February 2017, we started it, sort of thought we'd see how it goes. I'm happy to say that we have in the last 18 months now topped 300,000 downloads. Rob has a daily radio show on XM Radio in the U.S., and we've got video blogs, and we're actively promoting some of the good stories about agriculture that are out there. And then this is, and I know, there's actually people in the crowd that have been on the Ontario AgCast, on the podcast. We should do that. Raise your hand if you've ever been a guest on the Ontario AgCast. Carson, thank you. So we have developed a real network of people, and this is what I talked about when I said, you know, for me, doing the podcast has led to being connected with some of these people, and these people are people that I would, you know, lend a hand, and there's a community online. If you're not on social media, you don't have to be on social media. It's not for everybody, but there really is a community that exists. I have some friends and people that I care about that I only know from social media, and I only know online. And a good example of this, I have a friend who works for BASF in South Carolina, and last year at Christmas, she tried to book a plane ticket for her nanny to go home to Colombia. Don't ask me why she's got a Colombian nanny. And she booked it under the wrong name, and she booked it with Expedia, and I don't know if you know about Expedia, but trying to change a plane ticket is almost impossible. So she was out the $700 it was going to cost her because she booked the wrong name on this plane ticket. She would have to buy a whole new ticket. So she reached out to the community on social media, on Twitter, and Expedia is a company that only exists online, and so for them, that kind of exposure can be really good or really bad. She created enough of a fuss. She had people that got involved, and they sent messages to Expedia. They tweeted things, retweeted things. You know, they made snarky comments. She got a call from the president of Expedia who said, "We will change your ticket or refund it, whatever you want. Please make those people on Twitter stop." That's the kind of impact that that kind of movement can have. It can also have a negative impact. So if you're not on social media, you might think that, you know, it doesn't really matter much. But I can tell you that it doesn't matter to you. It matters to the people that are buying our products. A lot of the next generation are making decisions based on information they get from social media. And if we're not on there and we're not, you know, trying to put the right information out, the only information that they have available to them is the stuff that's being put out by activist groups and marketing companies. When I say marketing companies, I mean companies like A&W. I mean companies like, you know, the GMO-free group, the Butterfly. They put stuff out there in a smart and in an interesting way so that consumers are finding it and they're making decisions based on that. So we need to at least be aware of what's going on and at least be trying it. So what I'm doing with a weekly podcast and a blog and being active on social media, I might not be having any kind of an impact. There's no way to measure an impact that I'm having. I know there's a lot of things that I get out of it, and I've really enjoyed, you know, being involved and being sort of passionate about agriculture, even though I'm not a farmer. But at least I feel good about trying to do something positive. And I have to say, I couldn't do what I'm doing if it wasn't for working for a great company like I work for. This is Rick Martin, who's the general manager at Wallenstein Feeds, and he's making a donation to Farm and Food Care Ontario for, I think, $107,000 to do the last issue of The Real Dirt on Farming, which is a great organization that Farm and Food Care puts out to get real facts about agriculture into the hands of urban consumers. So I really appreciate working for a company that allows me the flexibility, allows me to do this kind of stuff, even though it puts us in the spotlight sometimes, and it does sometimes create issues. So the last lesson that I guess I want people to know, don't let anyone tell you what you're allowed to be passionate about. Please follow me on Twitter, follow me on Facebook, and check out the Farm and Rural Ag Network. And if anybody has ever listened to the podcast, they know I sign off every episode, which we just released episode number 106 today, and I sign everyone off. Thanks for listening. If this is the last podcast we ever do, it's been fun. If not, we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Just before you go away, Wendell, on behalf of the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture, I'd like to thank you very much and accept this token of our appreciation. Thank you very much. Good things from Waterloo. Just a couple thank yous before we end. Thank you to Ken Hunsberger for running the show in Waterloo. Thank you to Gord Grant for helping. And thank you to John and Pauline for doing that work on the financial stuff that many of us find difficult to do. So thank you for doing it. And thank you to all of you for being ambassadors for agriculture and continue to do it. And thanks for coming and have a good evening. Hope you enjoyed it tonight. Good night.